Deep Insight, Vipassana. Now let's explore another meditation practice. Deep Insight, Vipassana in Sanskrit, Vipassana in Pali. The way we perceive others and the world in general considerably influences our behavior and the way we live. We constantly impose our narrow view of reality on the world, and the resulting distortions turn into causes of frustration and suffering, because they inevitably clash with reality. How often have we decided that somebody or something was totally desirable or detestable? Taken in by the solidity of these concepts, we cling to me and mine with tremendous tenacity. Imagine you perceive the world of phenomena as a dynamic flow of interdependent events, of which the ceaselessly changing characteristics are the results of causes and conditions, and not intrinsic qualities of the objects they appear to define. The concepts of me and mine will now appear to you much more fluid, and will no longer be the object of such powerful fixations. Cultivating deep insight in this way is an essential practice for rooting out suffering and the fundamental misunderstandings that are the source of it. To develop deep insight, it is absolutely necessary to have a clear, concentrated, and stable mind, which is why it is important to prepare by practicing inner calm, or shamatha. Shamatha makes it possible to calm afflictive emotions temporarily, but it is not enough by itself, because it cannot eradicate them completely. Therefore, we need to continue by practicing deep insight. This will help us to recognize the basic nature of consciousness, the way emotions arise and become entangled with each other, and how our mental fabrications reinforce the self-centeredness of the ego. Deep insight will allow us, first through analysis and then through direct experience, to understand that phenomena are impermanent and interdependent, and thus do not have the tangible, independent existence that is ordinarily attributed to them. The result of this will be greater truth and freedom in the way we perceive the world. We will no longer be prisoners of our self-centered vision. We will be better able to cope with the emotional reactions brought about by our interaction with our surroundings. Vipassana can be practiced at different levels and in different ways. I will examine some aspects of it here. How to arrive at a more accurate understanding of reality. How to free ourselves from the torments of afflictive emotions. How to unmask the deceptions of the ego and the consequences of grasping onto the notion of an independent self and understand their influence on our suffering and well-being. How to understand the fundamental nature of the mind. Understanding reality better. What do I mean by reality? According to Buddhism, reality means the real nature of things, unmodified by the mental fabrications that create a discrepancy between the way things appear to us and the way they really are. This discrepancy is the source of continual conflicts with our world. Usually we perceive the external world as a composite of independent entities, to which we attribute characteristics that seem to be an inherent part of them. Thus, things appear to us as intrinsically nice or not nice, and people as basically good or bad. The I, or the ego, that perceives all this also seems real and concrete to us. This misunderstanding, which Buddhism refers to as ignorance, brings about the powerful reflexes of attachment and aversion, which, in turn, lead to an endless succession of painful experiences. According to Buddhist analysis, the world is a result of the coming together of an infinite number of causes and conditions that are continually changing. Just as a rainbow is formed at the precise moment the sun shines on a collection of raindrops and disappears as soon as the factors that produce it are no longer present, phenomena exist in an essentially interdependent mode and have no independent and permanent existence. Ultimate reality is therefore described as empty of independently existing animate or inanimate phenomena. Everything is relationship. Nothing exists in and of itself. Once this essential idea has been understood and assimilated, our erroneous perception of our ego and our world gives way to an accurate view of the nature of things and beings. Wisdom. Wisdom is not a simple intellectual construction or a compilation of information. It arises from a precise methodology that allows us progressively to eliminate mental blindness and the afflictive emotions that derive from it, and in that way, free us from the principal cause of suffering. The goal of the following meditation is to transform our perception of reality. It is described in contemporary terms, but it is based on a classical Buddhist philosophical analysis. Meditation. Imagine a freshly bloomed rose. It is so beautiful. Now imagine that you are a small insect nibbling on one of its petals. It tastes so good. Now imagine yourself as a tiger standing before this rose. For him, it makes no difference whether it is a flower or a bale of hay. Now transport yourself into the heart of this rose and imagine yourself as an atom there. You no longer exist except as pathways of energy in a kaleidoscopic universe, amid a whirl of particles passing through nearly empty space. Where did the rose go? Where is its color, form, texture, fragrance, its taste, its beauty? As for the particles, if you look at them closely, are they solid objects? Not really, the physicists say. They are events arising in the quantum void. They are waves of probability and, ultimately, of energy. Energy? Is that an entity? Isn't it more like a potential for manifestation that neither exists nor doesn't exist? What is left of the rose? Sources of inspiration. Like a flickering star, a mirage or a flame. Like a magical illusion, a dewdrop or a bubble on a stream. Like a dream, a flash of lightning or a cloud. See all compounded things as being like these. Chandrakirti. Like reflections on the surface of a clear lake, the multitude of phenomena manifests, completely devoid of inherent existence. This very day, acquire the certitude that everything is no more than reflections of emptiness. Longchen Rabjam. Subject and object are like sandalwood and its fragrance. Samsara and nirvana are like ice and water. Appearances and emptiness are like clouds and the sky. Thoughts and the nature of the mind are like waves and the ocean. Geshe Chayulpa. Lakes and rivers can freeze in winter, and the water can become so solid that people, animals, and carts travel back and forth on its surface. At the approach of spring, the earth warms up and the waters thaw. What remains then of all that solid ice? Water is soft and fluid, ice hard and sharp. We cannot say that they are identical, but neither are they different. Ice is only frozen water, and water is only melted ice. It is the same with our perceptions of the external world. To be attached to the reality of phenomena, tormented by attraction and repulsion, and obsessed by the 8 worldly preoccupations, is what causes the mind to freeze. The 8 worldly preoccupations are gain and loss, pleasure and pain, praise and blame, fame and obscurity. Melt the ice of your concepts so that the fluid water of free perception can flow. Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche. Recognition of the nature of the mind and an accurate understanding of the phenomenal world are essential for our quest for happiness. If the mind relies on totally erroneous views about the nature of things and maintains them, it will be very difficult for us to transform ourselves and achieve freedom. Developing a correct view is not a question of faith or adherence to dogma, but of clear understanding. This arises from a correct analysis of reality. Through this, little by little, the belief in the inherent existence of things, in which our erroneous conception of the world is rooted, is cast into doubt and replaced by an accurate view of phenomena. The 14th Dalai Lama. Dealing with thoughts and emotions. We often hear that the aim of Buddhism in general, and meditation in particular, is to suppress the emotions. Whether this is true or not depends on what we mean by emotion. If we are talking about mental disturbances, such as hatred and jealousy, why not get rid of them? If we are talking about powerful altruistic love, or about compassion for suffering beings, why not develop these qualities? These are the goals of meditation. Meditation teaches us how to deal with bursts of malicious anger or jealousy, with waves of uncontrolled desire, and with irrational fears. It frees us from the tyranny of mental states that obscure our judgment and are the source of constant distress. Buddhism speaks of mental poisons because these mental states truly poison our existence and that of others. The word emotion comes from the Latin emovere, which means to set in motion. An emotion is thus what sets the mind in motion, whether that motion takes the form of harmful, neutral, or wholesome thoughts. Emotion conditions the mind and leads it to adopt a certain perspective, a certain view of things. This view can be in accord with reality, as in the case of altruistic love and compassion, or distorted, as in the case of hatred or craving. As I pointed out earlier, altruistic love is an awareness of the fact that all beings wish, as we do, to be free from suffering. It is based on recognition of the basic interdependence of all beings, which we all are a part of. By contrast, hatred distorts reality by exaggerating the faults of its object and ignoring that object's good qualities. In the same way, avid desire makes us perceive its object as desirable from every point of view and ignore its faults. So we cannot but agree that certain emotions are afflictive and others are beneficial. If an emotion strengthens our inner peace and encourages us to seek the welfare of others, we can consider it positive or constructive. If it destroys our serenity, deeply troubles our mind, and leads us to harm others, it is negative or destructive. That is what differentiates, for instance, strong indignation or holy anger with regard to an injustice from anger motivated by the intention to harm somebody. The important thing, therefore, is not to try to suppress our emotions, which would be futile anyway, but to work with them in such a way that they contribute to our inner peace and lead us to think, speak, and act in a way that is helpful to others. To that end, we have to avoid becoming the helpless toy of our emotions. Learn to dissolve the negative emotions as they arise and cultivate the positive ones. We should also understand that it is the accumulation and interlocking of fleeting emotions and thoughts that create our moods. These moods can last for a few hours or a few days, and over the long term form our character tendencies and traits. That is why, if we learn to deal with our thoughts and emotions in a good way, little by little, thought after thought, emotion by emotion, day after day, in the end we will be able to transform our way of being. This is the essence of mind training and meditation with regard to emotions. Of the various methods for dealing with afflictive emotions through meditation, we will explain two. The first consists of applying antidotes. The second is not identifying with these temporary disturbances, while at the same time recognizing their true nature. Applying antidotes. The word antidote here refers to a state of mind that is diametrically opposed to the afflictive emotion we want to overcome. In the same way as a glass of water cannot be hot and cold at the same time, we cannot wish simultaneously to benefit and harm the same person. What we have to do is cultivate remedies powerful enough to neutralize the negative emotions that afflict us. Seen from another point of view, the more kindness and benevolence we develop, the less room there will be in our mind for their opposites, malice and ill will. The more light there is in a room, the more darkness is dispelled. In the meditations that follow, take desire and then malicious anger as examples. Desire. Everyone would agree that desire is natural and plays an essential role in helping us to realize our aspirations. But desire is only a blind force that in itself is neither helpful nor harmful. Everything depends on what kind of influence it has over us. It is capable both of providing inspiration in our lives and poisoning them. It can encourage us to act in a way that is constructive for ourselves and others. But it can also bring about intense pain. The latter is what happens when it becomes a possessive and pervasive craving. It then forces us to become dependent on the very causes of suffering. In that case, it is a source of unhappiness, and there is no advantage in continuing to be ruled by it. Apply the antidote of inner freedom to the desire that causes suffering. Meditation. If you are the victim of a strong desire that is troubling you and won't leave you alone, begin by examining its main characteristics and identifying the appropriate antidotes. One aspect of desire is urgency. To counter that urgency, calm your thoughts and observe the coming and going of the breath, as described earlier. Desire also has a restrictive and disturbing aspect. As an antidote to this, imagine the comforting and soothing quality of inner freedom. Spend a few moments allowing a feeling of freedom to arise and grow. Desire tends to distort reality and to make you view its object as fundamentally desirable. In order to regain a more accurate view of things, take the time to examine all aspects of the object of your desire and meditate for a few moments on its less attractive and less desirable sides. Finally, let your mind relax into the peace of awareness, free from hope and fear, and appreciate the freshness of the present moment, which acts like a balm on the burning of desire. Sources of inspiration. A peaceful mind does not mean a mind empty of thoughts, sensations, and emotions. A peaceful mind is not an absent one. Thich Nhat Hanh. Handle desire in the following manner. Notice the thought or sensation when it arises. Notice the mental state of desire which accompanies it as a separate thing. Notice the exact extent or degree of this desire. Then notice how long it lasts and when it finally disappears. When you have done that, return your attention to breathing. Bhante Hene Pola Gunaratna. If bliss it is to scratch an itch, what greater bliss no itch at all? So too, the worldly, desirous, find some bliss, but greatest is the bliss with no desire. Nagarjuna. Anger. The impulse of self-centered anger, which is the precursor of hatred, is to push aside whoever stands in the way of the ego's demands. It has no consideration for the welfare of others. It expresses itself as open hostility when the ego is in attack mode, and as resentment and bitterness when the ego is wounded, scorned, or slighted. Basic anger can also be associated with malice, the conscious desire to hurt someone. The mind overrun by animosity and resentment shuts itself up in illusion and convinces itself that the source of its frustration lies entirely outside itself. The truth is that even if resentment is triggered by an external object, it is not located anywhere else but in our mind. Moreover, if our hatred is a response to somebody else's hatred, we have stepped into a vicious circle that has no end. The following meditation is not intended to suppress hatred, but to turn our mind towards that which is diametrically opposed to it, love and compassion. Meditation. Think of someone who has been malicious towards you or people close to you. Someone who has made you suffer. Also, think of people who are causing or have caused tremendous suffering to others. Realize that if the mental poisons that led them to behave this way were to vanish from their minds, they would naturally cease to be your enemies and those of humanity. Wish with all your heart for this transformation to take place. To do this, make use of the meditation on altruistic love, in which, as you heard earlier, you formulate this wish as follows. May all sentient beings be liberated from suffering and the causes of suffering. May hatred, greed, arrogance, contempt, indifference, miserliness, and jealousy vanish from their minds and be replaced by altruistic love, contentment, modesty, appreciation, concern, generosity, and sympathy. Let this feeling of unconditional benevolence pervade all your thoughts. Sources of inspiration. It is the only thing we can do. Each of us must turn inward and destroy in himself all that he thinks he ought to destroy in others. And remember that every atom of hate we add to this world makes it still more inhospitable. Hetty Hillerson. I no longer believe that we can change anything in the world until we have first changed ourselves. And that seems to me the only lesson to be learned from this war. Hetty Hillerson. It is time to redirect hatred away from its usual targets, your so-called enemies, and towards itself. Indeed, hatred is your real enemy, and it is hatred that you should destroy. Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche. By giving in to anger, we are not necessarily harming our enemy, but we are definitely harming ourselves. We lose our sense of inner peace. We do everything wrong. Our digestion is bad. We cannot sleep well. We put off our guests, or we cast furious glances at those who have the impudence of being in our way. If we have a pet, we forget to feed it. We make life impossible for those who live with us, and even our dearest friends are kept at a distance. Since there are fewer and fewer people who sympathize with us, we feel more and more lonely. To what end? Even if we allow our rage to go all the way, we will never eliminate all our enemies. Do you know of anyone who ever has? As long as we harbor that inner enemy of anger or hatred, however successful we are at destroying our outer enemies today, others will emerge tomorrow. The 14th Dalai Lama. Stop identifying with emotions. The second way to deal with afflictive emotions is to dissociate ourselves mentally from the emotion that is troubling us. Usually we identify with our emotions completely. When we are overcome by anxiety or by a fit of anger, we are at one with it. It is omnipresent in our mind, leaving no room for other mental states such as inner peace, patience, or for considering reasoning that might calm our displeasure. However, if at that moment we are still capable of a little presence of mind, a capability that we can be trained to develop, we can stop identifying with our anger. The mind is, in fact, capable of examining what is happening within it. All we need to do is observe our emotions in the same way we would observe an external event taking place in front of us. The part of our mind that is conscious of the anger is just simply conscious. It is not angry. In other words, mindfulness is not affected by the emotion it is observing. Understanding that makes it possible to step back, to realize that this emotion has no substance, and to leave enough space for it to dissolve by itself. By doing so, we avoid two extremes, each as bad as the other. Repressing our emotion, which would then remain in a dark corner of our consciousness like a time bomb, or letting the emotion explode at the expense of those around us and of our own inner peace. Not identifying with emotions is a fundamental antidote that is applicable to all kinds of emotions in any circumstances. In the following meditations, I make use of the examples of anger and anxiety, but the process described would be the same for any other afflictive emotion. Meditation 1. Imagine that you are overcome by very strong anger. It seems to you that you have no choice but to let yourself be carried away. Helpless, your mind is repeatedly drawn to the object that triggered your rage, as iron is drawn to a magnet. Someone has insulted you, and the image of this person and his words constantly come to your mind. Every time you think of them, you set loose a new flood of resentment, which nourishes the vicious cycle of thoughts and reactions to those thoughts. It is time to change your tactics. Turn away from the object of your anger and contemplate the anger itself. This is a little like watching a fire, but no longer feeding it with wood. No matter how intense the fire is, in a little time it will go out all by itself. In the same way, if you turn your attention to simply looking at the anger, it is impossible for it to persist on its own. No matter how intense an emotion is, it will wear itself out and disappear naturally once you stop feeding it. Also understand that in the end, the most powerful anger attack is no more than a thought. Take a closer look at this. Where does the anger get the power to dominate you to this degree? Does it have a weapon? Can it burn you like fire? Can it crush you like a rock? Can you locate it in your chest, in your heart, or in your head? If the answer to this last question seems to be yes, does it have a color or a form? You would really have great difficulty in attributing such characteristics to it. When you look at a big black cloud in a stormy sky, it appears to be substantial enough to sit on. But if you fly into this cloud, you will find there is nothing solid to hold on to. There is nothing there but intangible mist. Similarly, when you attentively examine anger, you will find nothing in it that could justify the tyrannical influence it has over you. The more you try to pin it down, the more it melts away under your gaze, like frost under the rays of the rising sun. Finally, where does this anger come from? Where is it right now? Where does it disappear to? All you can say is that it comes from your mind, endures there for a while, then fades away back into it. As for the mind itself, it is ungraspable. It is not a distinct entity. It is nothing more than a stream of experiences. Meditation 2. If you notice that you have become anxious, when you are about to miss a plane, for instance, try to simply be fully aware of your anxiety. As you continue to do this, you will soon notice your anxiety begins to be less oppressive, and then gradually fades away. Why? Before you apply mindfulness, anxiety is the main component of your mind, filling its entire landscape. As you become aware of it, you experience both anxiety and the awareness of it. The part of your mind that is aware of anxiety is not anxious. It is just aware. Anxiety is now just one aspect of your mental landscape. As your awareness becomes more and more pervasive, anxiety loses its intensity and its grip on your mind. Eventually, it vanishes. If every time a powerful emotion arises, you learn to deal with it intelligently, not only will you master the art of liberating emotions at the moment they appear, but you will also erode the very tendencies that cause the emotions to arise. In this way, your character traits and your way of being will gradually be transformed. This method might seem difficult at the beginning, especially in the heat of the moment, but with practice, you will gradually get used to it. When anger or any other afflictive emotion begins to hatch in your mind, you will be able to identify it on the spot and be able to deal with it before it gets out of hand. It's a little like knowing the identity of a pickpocket. Even if he mingles with the crowd, you can spot him immediately and keep your eye on him so that he won't be able to steal your wallet. Thus, by becoming more and more familiar with the mechanisms of the mind and by cultivating mindfulness, you will reach the point where you no longer let sparks of nascent emotions turn into forest fires that can destroy your own happiness and that of others. This method can be used with all the afflictive emotions. It enables you to make a connection between the practice of meditation and the concerns of everyday life. If you get into the habit of looking at thoughts the moment they arise and letting them dissipate before they take hold of you, it will be much easier to retain mastery of your mind and to deal with the conflicting emotions in the thick of everyday activities. Sources of inspiration. Remember that thoughts are only the product of the momentary confluence of a great number of factors. In themselves, they do not exist. Thus, the moment they arise, recognize that their nature is emptiness. They will immediately lose their power to produce other thoughts, and the chain of illusion will be broken. Recognize the emptiness of thoughts, and let them relax into the natural clarity of the transparent and unaltered mind. Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche. When sunlight falls on a crystal, lights of all colors of the rainbow appear, yet they have no substance that you can grasp. Likewise, all thoughts in their infinite variety, devotion, compassion, harmfulness, desire, are utterly without substance. This is the mind of the Buddha. There is no thought that is something other than emptiness. If you recognize the void nature of thoughts, at the very moment they arise, they will dissolve. Attachment and hatred will never be able to disturb the mind. Deluded emotions will collapse by themselves. No negative actions will be accumulated, so no suffering will follow. Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche. Trying to find the ego. The idea of getting away from the influence of ego might be puzzling, especially if we think that in doing so we are tampering with our basic identity. Understanding the nature of the ego and the way it functions is crucial if we want to liberate ourselves from suffering. We know that at every moment, from the time of our birth onward, our body has been continually changing and innumerable new experiences have taken place in our mind. Still, we instinctively imagine that somewhere deep down within us, there resides an enduring entity that endows our personality with solid reality and permanence. This intuition may seem so evident, we don't think it is necessary to examine it any further. We end up developing a powerful attachment to the notions of me and mine. My body, my name, my mind, my possessions, my friends, and so on. This attachment brings with it either a desire to possess or repulse the other. An insurmountable duality between self and other becomes crystallized in our mind. Our being becomes equated with an imaginary entity, the self. From this mental construction arises an exaggerated sense of the importance of this self. The ego places its fictitious identity at the center of all our experiences. However, as soon as we seriously analyze the nature of the ego, we see that it is impossible to pinpoint a distinct identity that corresponds to it. In the end, we realize the ego is no more than a concept that we associate with the continuum of experiences that is our consciousness. Our identification with the ego is fundamentally dysfunctional because it is out of step with reality. We attribute to the ego the qualities of permanence, singularity, and autonomy. The ego fragments the world and definitively solidifies the division between self and other, mine and not mine. Because it is based on a mistake, it is constantly threatened by reality, and this gives us a deep and ongoing sense of insecurity. Since we are aware of the ego's vulnerability, we try by all means available to protect and reinforce it. As a result, we feel aversion towards anything that threatens it, and attraction towards anything that feeds it. From these impulses of repulsion and attraction, a multitude of conflicting emotions is born. We might think that by devoting most of our time to satisfying and reinforcing the ego, we are adopting the best possible strategy for achieving happiness. But this turns out to be a losing bet, because just the opposite happens. By imagining an independent ego, we put ourselves in a state of conflict with the nature of things, and this results in endless frustration and pain. Devoting all our energy to this imaginary entity critically damages the quality of our lives. The only kind of self-confidence the ego can achieve is an artificial one, based on shaky factors such as power, success, beauty, physical strength, intellectual brilliance, and the opinions of others. All things that are related to our image. Genuine self-confidence is something entirely different. Paradoxically, it is a natural quality of the absence of ego. To dispel the illusion of the ego is to free yourself from a fundamental weakness. Self-confidence based on non-ego brings a sense of freedom that is not subject to emotional contingencies. You experience a lack of vulnerability to the judgments of others and an inner acceptance of whatever circumstances may exist. This sense of freedom manifests as openness towards whatever arises. It is not something frigid and aloof. It is not the dry detachment or indifference people sometimes imagine when they think of Buddhist non-attachment. Rather, it is a daring and kind-hearted availability that reaches out to all beings. When the ego is not reveling in its triumphs, it nourishes itself on its failures by setting itself up as a victim. Fed by its ceaseless broodings, its suffering confirms its existence just as much as its euphoria does. Whether it is riding high or feeling reduced, slighted, and ignored, the ego solidifies itself by paying attention only to itself. The ego is the result of a mental activity that creates and keeps an imaginary entity alive in our mind. It is an imposter who gets caught up in his own game. One of the functions of deep insight, vipassana, is to unmask the deception of the ego. The fact is that we are not this ego. We are not this anger. We are not this despair. Our most fundamental level of experience is pure awareness, the primary quality of consciousness that I referred to earlier, that is the basis of all experience, of all emotion, of all reasoning, of all concept, of all mental constructs, including the ego. But attention, which is pure consciousness, pure awareness, is not some new entity more subtle than the ego. Rather, it is the fundamental quality of our mental stream. The ego is nothing more than a mental construct that lasts longer than the others, because it is constantly being reinforced by our mental associations. But that does not prevent it from being an illusory concept that is devoid of all inherent existence. A movie that lasts 100 years is no more real than a movie that lasts an hour. This stubborn label that is the ego can only stick to the stream of our consciousness through the application of the magic glue of mental confusion. In order to unmask the deception of the ego, we must carry out a full and thorough investigation. If we sense the presence of a thief in our house, we have to look through every room, every nook and cranny, every possible hiding place, until we reach the point where we are sure there is really no one there. Only then can our minds rest. Meditation. Look and see what it is that composes the I, the ego. Is it the body? The body is a composite of flesh and bone. Is it consciousness? Consciousness is a succession of fleeting thoughts. Your history? Your history is only memories of things that no longer exist. Your name? You attach all sorts of concepts to a name. Your genealogy, your reputation, your social status. But in the end, it is no more than a combination of letters. If the ego really was your profound essence, your fear of doing away with it would be understandable. However, if it is only an illusion, liberating yourself from it would not be destroying the core of your being, but just correcting an error and opening your eyes to reality. Error offers no more resistance to knowledge than darkness does to light. Darkness that has lasted for millions of years can disappear in an instant the moment a lamp is lit. When the I ceases to be considered the center of the world, you naturally develop concern for others. Self-centered contemplation of your own suffering discourages you, whereas altruistic care for the suffering of others just redoubles your determination to work for their relief. So the profound sense of an I at the core of your being is clearly something you have to subject to an honest examination. Where is this I located? It can't be in my body, because when I say, I'm sad, it's my consciousness that feels the sense of sadness, not my body. Is the I then only in my consciousness? That is far from being clear. When I say, somebody pushed me, is it my consciousness that was pushed? Obviously not. But the I cannot be located outside both the body and the consciousness. So is the notion of I to be connected with a combination of body and consciousness? That would take us to a very abstract concept. The only solution to this dilemma is to consider the I as a mental designation for a dynamic process, a composite of changing relationships that bring together your sensations, your mental images, your emotions, and your concepts. In the end, the I is no more than a name you use to designate a continuum in the same way that you call a river Amazon or Ganges. Every river has a history. It flows through a unique landscape, and its water might have healing properties or be polluted. For that reason, it is legitimate to give it a name and distinguish it from another river. However, no entity exists in the river that could be called its core or essence. In the same way, the I, or the ego, exists only as a convention, not at all in the form of an entity that constitutes the core of your being. The ego always has something to lose and something to gain. Natural simplicity of mind has nothing to lose and nothing to gain. It is not necessary to add anything to it or take anything away. The ego feeds on dwelling on the past and anticipating the future, but it cannot survive in the simplicity of the present moment. Rest in that simplicity, in the mindfulness of the present moment, which is freedom, the ultimate resolution of all conflicts, all fabrications, all mental projections, all distortions, all identifications, and all divisions. It is worthwhile to devote a little of our time to letting our mind rest in the inner calm that will help you to better understand the role of the ego in our life. This can be done both through analysis and direct experience. As long as a sense of self-importance rules our being, we will never know lasting peace. The very cause of pain itself will remain hidden deep within and will deprive us of the most essential of all freedoms. Abandoning grasping onto the ego and ceasing to identify with it brings tremendous inner freedom. This is a freedom that allows us to relate to anyone we meet, in any situation, with naturalness, goodwill, courage, and serenity. Having nothing to gain and nothing to lose, we are free to give and receive everything. Meditating on the nature of the mind. Having a clear understanding of the mind is essential to unravel the mechanisms of happiness and suffering. That is why psychologists, specialists in neuroscience, and philosophers investigate the nature of the mind. It is, after all, our mind that we have to deal with, from morning till night, and it is our mind, in the end, that determines the quality of every moment of our existence. So if knowing the mind's true nature and understanding its mechanisms will exercise a decisive influence on our quality of life, then we have good reason to investigate it. If we do not investigate it, if we fail to understand our own mind, then we remain a stranger to ourselves. When the mind examines itself, what can it learn about its own nature? The first thing it notices is the endless series of thoughts that pass through it. These feed our sensations, our imagination, our memories, and our projections about the future. Do we also find a luminous quality in the mind that illuminates our experience, no matter what its content? This luminous quality is the fundamental cognitive faculty that underlies all thought. It is that which, when we are angry, sees the anger without letting itself be drawn into it. This simple, pure awareness can be called pure consciousness because it can be perceived even in the absence of concepts and mental constructs. The practice of meditation reveals that when we let our thoughts calm down, we are able to remain for a few moments in the non-conceptual experience of pure awareness. It is this fundamental aspect of consciousness, free from the veils of confusion, that Buddhism calls the nature of mind. Thoughts arise out of pure awareness and dissolve back into it, just as waves arise in the ocean and fall back into it without ever becoming anything other than the ocean itself. It is essential to realize this if we want to free ourselves from the habitual automatic patterns of thought that create suffering. Identifying the fundamental nature of mind and knowing how to rest in it in a non-dual and non-conceptual way is one of the essential conditions for inner peace and liberation from suffering. Meditation. A thought arises as though from nowhere. It might be a pleasant thought or a troubling one. It stays for a few moments and then dies away, to be replaced by others. When it disappears, like the sound of a bell fading, where does it go? No one can say. Certain thoughts recur frequently in your mind, where they create states ranging from joy to sadness, desire to indifference, resentment to sympathy. In this way, thoughts have tremendous power to condition our state of being. But where do they get this power? They don't have an army at their command, nor do they possess fuel to start a fire with. They don't have stones they can stone you with. They are only mental constructs, so they should not be able to harm you. Let your mind observe itself. Thoughts arise. The mind exists in some way because you experience it. Apart from that, what could be said about it? Examine your mind and the thoughts that arise there. Can any concrete characteristics be attributed to them? Do they have a location? Do they have a color? A form? The more you look, the less you find. You note, of course, that the mind has a capacity to know, but it has no other intrinsic and real characteristic. This is the reason Buddhism defines the mind as a continuum of experiences. It does not constitute a distinct entity. It is empty of inherent existence. Having found nothing in any way substantial, remain for a few moments in this state of not having found anything. When a thought appears, just let it arise and pass away by itself, without either blocking or prolonging it. During the brief time that your mind is not burdened by any discursive thought, contemplate its nature. In this gap, after past thoughts have ceased and future thoughts have not yet appeared, do you perceive a consciousness that is pure and luminous? Remain a few moments in this state of natural simplicity, free from concept. As we gradually familiarize ourselves with the nature of mind and learn to let thoughts pass away as soon as they arise, just like a letter written on water, we begin to progress more easily on the path of inner freedom. Automatic thought patterns no longer have the same power to perpetuate our confusion and reinforce our habitual tendencies. We distort reality less and less, and the very mechanisms of suffering finally disappear. Since, at this point, we have the inner resources to deal with our emotions, our feelings of insecurity give way to freedom and confidence. We cease to be preoccupied exclusively by our hopes and fears and become available to the people around us. In this way, we bring about the welfare of others at the same time as our own. This is a long process that develops in stages until it finally reaches fruition. All the stages of progress are beneficial, so we should not be impatient, but persevere and appreciate the true and lasting changes that gradually occur in our way of being, rather than feeling discouraged when progress does not happen immediately. Sources of inspiration. Past mind has completely come to an end. Future mind has not yet occurred. Present mind is very hard to circumscribe. It has no shape. It has no color. It is like space, insubstantial and unreal. Since this is so, one can come to realize that mind lacks intrinsic existence. Atisha Dipamkara. When a rainbow appears vividly in the sky, you can see its beautiful colors, yet you could not wear it as clothing or put it on as an ornament. It arises through the conjunction of various factors, but there is nothing about it that can be grasped. Likewise, thoughts that arise in the mind have no tangible existence or intrinsic solidity. There is no logical reason why thoughts, which have no substance, should have so much power over you, nor is there any reason why you should become their slave. The endless succession of past, present, and future thoughts leads you to believe that there is something inherently and consistently present, and you call it mind. But actually, past thoughts are as dead as a corpse. Future thoughts have not yet arisen. So how could these two, which do not exist, be part of an entity that inherently exists? However, that void nature of mind is not just a blank emptiness like empty space. There is an immediate awareness present. This clarity of mind is like the sun, illuminating the landscape and allowing you to see mountain, path, and precipice, where to go and where not to go. Although the mind does have this inherent awareness, to say there is a mind is to give a label to something that does not exist, to assume the existence of something that is no more than a name given to a succession of events. 108 beads strung together, for example, can be called a rosary. But that rosary is not a thing that exists inherently on its own. If the string breaks, where did the rosary go? Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche. Gradually I began to recognize how feeble and transitory the thoughts and emotions that had troubled me for years actually were, and how fixating on small problems had turned them into big ones. Just by sitting quietly and observing how rapidly, and in many ways illogically, my thoughts and emotions came and went, I began to recognize in a direct way that they weren't nearly as solid or real as they appeared to be. And once I began to let go of my belief in the story they seemed to tell, I began to see the author beyond them, the infinitely vast, infinitely open awareness that is the nature of mind itself. Any attempt to capture the direct experience of the nature of mind in words is impossible. The best that can be said is that the experience is immeasurably peaceful, and once stabilized through repeated experience, virtually unshakable. It's an experience of absolute well-being that radiates through all physical, emotional, and mental states, even those that might be ordinarily labeled as unpleasant. This sense of well-being, regardless of the fluctuation of outer and inner experiences, is one of the clearest ways to understand what Buddhists mean by happiness. Yonge Mingyo Rinpoche. The nature of the mind is comparable to the ocean, to the sky. The incessant movement of waves on the surface of the ocean prevents us from seeing its depths. If we dive down, there are no more waves. There is just the immense serenity of the depths. The nature of the ocean is immutable. Look at the sky. It is sometimes clear and transparent. At other times, clouds accumulate and modify the perception we have of it. Nevertheless, the clouds do not change the nature of the sky. The mind is nothing if not a totally free nature. Remain in the natural simplicity of the mind, which is beyond all concepts. Pema Wangyal Rinpoche.